Hey guys, Mark Taylor from TaylorMade Sales. I know you got a big milestone coming up, 50th edition of the TDM podcast. You can do a hell of a job. Just keep it rolling.
Good morning. It is 10:11, Wednesday, August 19th. This is the TDN Writers Room presented by Keeneland, the 50th episode. My name is Joe Bianca. I'm the associate editor of the Thoroughbred Daily News, and Bill just informed me that we're risking our lives. There's a tornado outside, apparently.
Yes, what I won't do for the TDN podcast, I'm doing this in the middle, literally, of a tornado. So if I'm literally blown off the screen in a few seconds, you know why. And I don't want to start this podcast on a down note, but I have some devastating news for Brian DiDonato. I confirmed this morning before coming on that Harvey's Lil Goyle will not be running in the Kentucky Oaks. Brian, I hope you're okay now.
That's good. And it'll save me some money in the race. So I'm happy. That's good news for me, actually.
Jonathan Green, general manager from DJ Stable. And the fact that Harvey's Lil Goyle is not running in the Oaks, does that mean that she's going to start her continental trip of going from racetrack to racetrack so people can go and pay homage to how good she is?
Brian DiDonato, racing editor at the TDN, managing partner of Franklin Ave Equine. Ignore the boxes in the background. We're still getting settled in Louisville.
I think Harvey's Lil Goyle is just prepping for next year's arc. That's what Bill suggested for her last time. So I think that, that makes sense. Take some time off for that.
Is there going to be a Harvey's Lil Goyle back-o-meter? She's back? No? Well, Bill's head on it?
She never left. She doesn't.
Yeah,
she doesn't
exactly.
She never left.
Don't call it a comeback.
That's right. Exactly. Exactly. It is literally raining sheets of water right now outside of our door and outside of our windows, I should say, with hail, basically wind and, you know, little totos and girls in pigtails flying around. It's crazy outside right now.
Just wanted a show for the 50th episode. Just wanted a little apocalyptic show to go along with it.
Mother Nature has given us a show for sure.
TDN Writers Room is presented by Keeneland. A reminder that the Keeneland September Yearling Catalog, featuring 4,272 yearlings, is online now. You can visit it at september.keeneland.com. So over the weekend, there was the 68th annual roundtable conference hosted by the Jockey Club. And I think overall, it's a really good exercise. It's something that we kind of talk about a lot, about how racing doesn't really address its structural issues and doesn't think about things in a new way. This is an exception to that. I think that the Jockey Club does a really good job of bringing prominent voices on and also some kind of outside the box guests as well to talk about things that can really be adjusted, you know, at a ground level to fix racing. One of the main themes I thought was, and T. Thornton did some good reporting on this, about fixing the claiming game and, you know, just overall making it so that there are bigger fields, there are better horses running, there's less restrictive racing. Mark Cassie talked a lot about drugs, and we'll get to that. So did John Gosden. There were a couple of good guests in that regard. But I wanted to start with a quote from Sal Sinatra, who is the president and general manager of the Maryland Jockey Club. And he was talking about the transition to more claiming races that we've had in America in the past couple of decades. He said, idealistically, the thought was to raise purses to help owners of claiming horses pay their bills and upgrade their stock over time. Instead, we've created an arena that is a race to the bottom with horses being dropped in claiming price and repeatedly claimed as a matter of arbitrage. The main point was that the purses relative to the claiming prices have gotten a lot higher. It used to be pretty similar, claiming price and the purse of the race. Now you can sometimes see three or four times the purse level for the claiming tag. And it really incentivizes a lot of people to dump horses and drop horses in class because you can still make money off of them. This is something that I think, you know, will be phased out over time in racing. I think there's way too many claiming races. You look around the country, and it's a lot of sad racing, I think. A lot of sad products across the country in terms of claiming races, horses that probably shouldn't be running, a lot of unsound horses most likely, but it's not an easy fix. So I wanted to open it up to the floor, and especially our two owners, Brian and John, on the panel here. Do you think that the claiming race, the claiming purse to price level is screwed up? Do you think it incentivizes, you know, bad actors? What do you think can be done to fix this issue? Because, you know, it really is starting to dominate the sport, except at the very top tracks.
And I agree with your sentiment about it's a wonderful thing that they had the round table, even though it was virtual this year. Because as an industry, we need to come together and talk about a lot of these issues. And we're not always going to agree. And I'm sure even on this panel, we're going to have some different viewpoints on some of the things that were discussed and some of the balloons that were floated as far as how to fix the situation. I think one of the other quotes that Sal Sinatra had, Joe, as well, is that the claiming races make up almost 70% of all the races in the United States. And I think that there's a couple of reasons why. You mentioned, that people are more aggressive with dropping horses down. The race to the bottom, I believe, was the quote that Sal had with regard to the claiming ranks. But one of the things that you're also seeing is that people are giving up on horses a lot sooner, or they're getting super aggressive. And I've noticed that over the years, what's happened is that they're like everything else in the business, there's been a divide. And either you have a good horse and you run it from maiden race to a stake race immediately, or you have a not great horse and you run it from a maiden race, you break it to maiden and you cut it in half. And then you run it in various claiming races. So I think there's definitely a divide there. My understanding also from the economics of it is that a lot of these racetracks wanted to have more claiming races than allowance races. Because it was the purse money, cost less money, quite frankly. So the product cost less to actually put onto the racetrack and have available for people to gamble on. And that was a positive for the bottom line of these racetracks. So I was a little perplexed as to why, the GM and president of the Maryland Racing would recommend that we have less claiming races and more higher purse races. I would love it. But I just didn't see where that made economic sense for them. And then the third thing that I've noticed is that as an owner, you can't get allowance races to go. And I'm sure Brian, you'll back me up on this. But if you have a horse that wins first time out, and then you want to run it in an allowance race, that the years ago it was you won a maiden race, you won an A other than, you won a two other than, and then you graduated into a stake race. Now because horses are so expensive, you want to get black type immediately because that's going to add value to that horse and to your overall stable. So as far as your original question of how do you fix it, I don't know if the claiming, one of the reasons why Sal Sinatra brought up that claiming races were an issue is because based on the study that they did, more horses per race broke down in claiming races than in any other group. Allowance races, stake races, they had less, fatalities. And I think that they're skewing the answer to this problem. The problem is horses are breaking down and more of them are breaking down in claiming races. Then I think we have to look at why horses are breaking down. And it's the same racetrack surface. It's the same circumstances and rules and regulations for claimers or allowance or stake horses. So it's got to be in the training aspect of it, or in just keeping these horses around longer than their shelf life is. And I remember years ago, New York actually had a minimum claiming race. And Joe, I think you'll remember this as well, where if you didn't finish first, second, or third in a claiming race under $10,000, you were ineligible to run in New York. You couldn't go to Aqueduct or Belmont or Saratoga unless you graduated from that. And I think that kept a lot of I don't want to say broken down horses, but a lot of horses on the back end of their careers out of the major racetracks and maybe going on to greener pastures, where they could retire or be hunter jumpers or ponies because they weren't going to be racehorses anymore.
So John's answer was so long that Bill had to run out real quick. He thought he could run out and come back in time, but he wasn't able to make it back. But in all seriousness, he's lost power right now because he's in the middle of this 50th episode tornado. But we're going to continue this discussion, and I want to hear from Brian about what he thought about these roundtable discussions.
Yeah, so I kind of have conflicting thoughts on the claiming versus no claiming and maybe instituting a class system. I do agree. I don't think claiming races are particularly good for the well-being of horses. I think it kind of, allows for a lot of aggressive spotting and, trainers just running horses who they're hoping to lose, who obviously aren't 100%. I mean, you see it every day, a short-priced horse getting plunged much lower than you think they'd be worth. And there being a shake and obviously the horse never kind of coming back the same. So from that perspective, I agree. there's probably a better way. I guess my one hesitation, there's been a lot of talk about kind of instituting a rating system like they have in Europe or Hong Kong or wherever, and then having paddock sales. My concern with the paddock sales aspect is that the nice thing about claiming is it's an affordable way for a new trainer or a new owner to get in the game and have a chance of maybe, you know, getting lucky and getting the right horse that can move up, you know, a few levels and do well. I think it's going to be tough if you just have a straight auction where the bigger claiming outfits will now become the outfits that are willing to pay another $3,000 for the horse that's a class A horse or whatever it is. And it's going to kind of further increase that kind of unlevel playing field. So that's kind of my one concern with it. It might still be better than the current system. And if, you know, if we all agree that horse welfare is the primary concern, then it probably is better. But I wonder if there's maybe a little bit better way to do it. Like I'm just thinking of at Oaklawn, if you had that system and auctions every week at Oaklawn, there would be one outfit that would pretty much, they're dropping on in every race anyways, and they're claiming a lot of horses. They'd be buying pretty much every horse, every interesting horse out of those sales. And I don't know if that helps the general economics and, you know, the general racing economy.
I think, you know, we've touched on this before, but I think it also encourages, you know, domination of juicing trainers because, you know, with horses changing hands so often, you know, there are certain people who are going to have an edge if they're using performance enhancing drugs, being able to take horses from all these other barns and move them up. But you don't have that with the allowances and the stakes system where, you know, it's basically just private purchases. And those are like pretty rare in terms of, you know, transferring a horse from one barn to another. So I think it you know, encourages people to kind of bend the rules a little bit and try to get an edge in terms of moving horses up. Because the thing is, there's a lot of horses that are running, you know, especially towards the tail end of their careers where they are what they are. They're not going to go forward. They're only going to go backward over time. And if you can finesse that into improving an 8-9-year-old horse, which we've seen a lot with certain trainers in this country, I think that also incentivizes people to keep racing horses way past their prime and keep racing horses who are unsound and don't really need to be on the racetrack anymore. I don't know what this says about me, but I was looking at the Finger Lakes card yesterday because there was a pick five carryover.
You can stop right there, Joe. You can stop
right there. Hey, listen, that's where you can find some value because not everyone is going to pour into like the money into the carryover as they would at like a bigger track like Saratoga or Del Mar. Anyway, but the first horse in the first race of the sequence was a horse who's a 12-year-old gelding and had just like run off the board in his seasonal debut and ran off the board again yesterday. So there's a lot of that going on in American racing. And you don't see that, I think, overseas. And it's not an easy fix, but it's just, there's so much bad racing, so many bad horses, so many tired old horses that are running in this sport. And major reason for it is the claiming game. And it's not something you're going to be able to remedy or get rid of overnight. Because like Brian said, I think it's a good point that it is kind of it lowers the barrier to entry for a lot of people who don't have the money to go spend a bajillion dollars at auction, like John Green, where you can like get your feet wet in racing. And, you know, you never know, you could claim like a cheap broodmare and turn her around at the sales. So it is a good way for new owners and smaller owners to get into the sport. But overall, there's too much cheap racing. There's too many, you know, old tired horses that are being made to run in this country. And I think it's something that a lot of people don't want to talk about. So I you know, salute the Jockey Club for taking this head on, and especially Mark Cassie. We'll talk a little bit more about some stuff that he had to say, but he was very outspoken about this. And he mentioned, you know, horses breaking down more often in claiming races. And I don't think that's arguable. And I think that should be our main concern. And it's, like I said, it's not something that's going to be easily fixed, but it's something we got to work on. So we don't want everyone to panic. Bill did not blow away in the tornado. He is back and back online with us. And I know he's got some thoughts on the claiming game and its effect on the sport.
Well, I hope I'm not going to be redundant because I didn't get a chance to hear what everybody else said. But here's my one thought about this. And one of the complaints that people have about the Jockey Club Roundtable is that they come up with a lot of good ideas and a lot of cogent thoughts about how to improve the industry and how to move things forward. Then nothing ever happens. I imagine that the panel is in agreement with what Sal Sinatra had to say. And again, I didn't get to hear everybody's comments, but let's do something about it. One thing that I was a little curious, why didn't Sal say after it was over, and here at the Maryland Jockey Club and the Sternick Group, we are going to aggressively pursue a new system, you know, totally breaking down the model, totally reinventing the wheel, but come up with a new model for how we're going to do the lower level horses and do away with claiming races, maybe not just overnight, but eventually. And again, I apologize if someone else mentioned this, but, you know, a lot of things that in U.S. racing are unique to U.S. racing, the way we do things. And, you know, maybe the people are a little bit more up on international racing can correct me, but claiming outside of North America is a very small part of racing. So why couldn't it be part of racing here, or part of racing would become, let's not have claiming races and see how that moves things forward. So I would just call on people who agree with Sal Sinatra, the Maryland Jockey Club itself, to be proactive now. Let's just not talk about this. Let's really explore doing this.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard because I was saying before, it's such a big percentage of racing in this country that if you just did away with the claiming game overnight, it'd be a lot of horses that would need homes that really can't compete in these allowance conditions. But I also wanted to mention something else that Mark Cassie said, and he was talking about the restrictive ways that races are written, particularly claiming races, and also state bred programs. He said, honestly, and I'm going to upset a lot of people when I say this, but probably the thing that has hurt our breed the most in the U.S. is the state programs. He said he was blunt about too many stallions and broodmares being employed that would never cut the mustard on the open market. He said, I went to California some time ago with three exceptional maidens that wanted to run long, couldn't get the race to go, but the California bred race would go once a week. And I think this is also kind of an elephant in the room that needs to be addressed, is that every single state has a state bred program now that kind of, you know, encourages people to run cheap horses and a lot of times to run horses that would not be able to make it in the marketplace in open races. I just, from my personal experience, you know, watching New York racing, just as a better, just as a handicapper, as a fan, there's just so many horses that just run against each other over and over and over and over again. You just get so sick of watching them run. And it's just, I don't know, it dilutes the product because you don't have new blood. You don't have horses that are running that would normally be able to compete at a track like Belmont or Saratoga. And I get it. I get why these states want to, you know, encourage the breeding programs. And a lot of it, I think, has to do with casino money in a lot of states. But it's just, you know, when you have like horses that are like Iowa bred at Prairie Meadows running for more money than open races, I think that's kind of a problem, and it cheapens the rest of the product when there are so many restricted spots that you can run your horses in that we don't have these big allowance stakes fields that, you know, are supposed to be filled at these tracks. I'll toss it back to John. I wonder if you have any thoughts on the state bred programs.
Yeah, the state bred programs we've talked about for a number of years as far as, you know, why they're in existence, and quite frankly, they're in existence for jobs. And not just jobs at the racetrack, but it's the breeding farms, it's the facilities, it's the feed man, it's the local vets, it's all the people that don't work on the racetrack, but still, you know, take care of these animals and athletes, you know, mostly on breeding farms. So there's definitely a reason why states want to have a state bred program, and it is totally propped up. I mean, it is not necessary, other than maybe the top 10% of each, you know, representative state, those horses could run anywhere, but the rest of them don't really deserve to run at the major tracks. That being said, we've been talking about, you know, for a year, and even before we started this podcast, we talked amongst ourselves about how, you know, it's difficult to gain barrier of entry into the business. You know, it used to be, again, where you can claim a horse for $5,000, $10,000 and run it a few times and get your feet wet and then get an understanding for what's going on. These kind of state bred horses give people an opportunity to buy at a lower price point and have an opportunity to get out on the horses because they can win inflated purses. Okay, so I understand that it's not necessarily the sexiest races in the world, but there is a need for these kind of horses because you need it's a way to get, you know, jobs, and it's a way to get employment and money into the states. But more importantly, from my standpoint, it's a way to get new people into the business where they can afford to get in, win, make some money, and then get hooked and then lose, you know, money 10 times over, which is what the rest of us do anyway. You know, you get it in your blood and then you keep, you know, buying and buying and buying and keep spending to be in the business. So I think there is, all kidding aside, there is a means to an end as far as why we needed to have these state bred programs. But whatever plan we put into place for a minimum barrier of entry for these horses to come to certain racetracks for claimers, I think we need to do for state bred also. And Bill, the only thing that you missed that you kind of touched on when you were gone was we were saying how years we were romancing about the fact that years ago, you know, New York had a minimum to get in. Like you had to finish first, second, or third in a claiming race of under $10,000 in order to gain entry into a race in New York. And I think that they got rid of it, but they need to look at that, you know, especially on the major track circuits. They need to get, you know, to look at that again, where you need to finish or you need to earn a certain amount of money within a certain period of time in order to be able to run at, you know, Belmont or Saratoga or, you know, one of the Fonner Park, one of the major tracks.
I have a couple points here. I totally respect Mark Cassidy's opinion. I don't get the sort of denigration of state bred programs. I don't really see what's wrong with, you know, a California track holding a lot of cowbred races for people who live in California and breed horses in California. You know, and the idea that state breds are inferior has kind of gone out the window, especially obviously New York breds. I mean, the best 3-year-old in the country is a New York bred. So I don't really see anything wrong with having incentives for people to breed in a certain state.
You know, I think it's more about one brood mare. I think it's more about the balance, you know, right? The relative number of state bred races to open races that don't fill.
Well, it'd be wonderful if every horse that was bred in America was an allowance worthy Kentucky bred who could run a 90 buyer. But the reality is that's not true. And it's the same thing with the claiming. You know, we want it to be 10 races of 12 horse allowance fields. Most horses are never going to be that good. And I think we need to make the distinction between taking issue with claiming races because they may not be great for animal welfare and taking issue with them because they involve slow horses. I mean, the reality is there are a lot of slow horses, and if there's no out for those horses, if there's no level for them to compete at, why would anyone ever buy a horse? I mean, you're just going to really, really, really constrict things and lose a ton of owners. So there still needs to be an outlet for the lesser horses. And I agree with the idea that too many, they're, a lot of mares that get bred that really have no business being bred. I mean, looking through these catalogs, you definitely see ones like, man, why did, you know, how did, first of all, you say, how did that horse get to that stallion? And, you know, you wonder why some of these people are breeding some of these mares. But again, you need to, if we're just going to, you know, contract everything and we're going to have three tracks running and only the tappets and everything are going to run, I guess that's one way to go about it. But if we're going to have a healthy, larger industry, we still need to find an outlet for these less talented horses. And they can come from anywhere. I mean, there are plenty of $2 million horses by big stallions that have no ability, but they might find their level at, you know, a Prairie Meadows or wherever it is.
Hey, Brian, I want to jump in here. I don't think anybody's suggesting that you wouldn't have an outlet for these horses. Of course, you have to. And, you know, that point of yours is well taken. But it just because you might do things differently doesn't mean the quote unquote slow horses won't have a place to run. I mean, you're absolutely right. If you just said only horses that can run, like you said, the 90 buyers and allowance horses and everybody else, forget it. Just you can go home now. Just a different way of doing it. And again, it's done that way in virtually every other country in the world, you know, be it a handicap system, even, you know, I shudder to even bring up dog racing because, you know, of all the ugly connotations of that. But that's how it's done in dog racing. You have A dogs, B dogs, C dogs, D dogs, et cetera. Now, I mean, that's a radical change from what we've been doing. But, you know, you're classified as an A dog. And then if you, like, finish worse than fourth, like two straight starts or something like that, you drop down to B. And then if you win at B, you go up to A. Again, you know, that's a radical change and people might be afraid to do something that different. But, you know, you're right. Absolutely, you have to have a place for these horses to go. But I think the question is there a better way of doing it than what we do in the United States now? And, you know, you can pick up the models from, you know, any other country in Europe. You know, and even one thing Dick Mandela used to talk about 10, 12 years ago, I haven't heard it. He said, do like they have in England where there's the selling races. And then it's a race where only the winner is sold afterwards, after the race. So that's another way of looking at it. So if you're going to drop a horse down from 25 to 12.5 and you know the horse isn't any good and is going to run up the track, well, you're going to be stuck with the horse because the only way you can get rid of the horse is if it wins the race. So there's still another way of doing it. So I just think different is not the same as just doing away with races for lesser horses.
Yeah, no, I get that. I was just kind of responding to a couple, you know, few things that were said. I guess my other hesitation is, you know, we like to cite Europe and these other places as, you know, kind of the grass is greener. It's a lot tougher, I think, as an owner to make it in Europe than it is in America. You'll see a field at a high level track and, you know, you add up the value of every horse and it's millions of dollars and they're competing for like 12,000 pounds or euros or whatever.
Yeah, purses are terrible there for the most part.
So I don't know. I mean, I don't know that the economics of, I think they have a more contracted kind of landscape in general, and that's probably where we're heading anyways. But I think it's important to keep that in mind too.
I think another way to, you know, let some of these cheaper horses run without the nefarious drop downs that we see is starter allowances. And I think I've seen a lot of tracks move towards starter allowances. There's a lot more starter stakes. I think Gulfstream does a good job with that. Every once in a while, they have a day full of starter stakes for horses that were in claiming races. And just, you know, it's a good outlet for horses who are on the cheaper side, who don't have to be risked for the tag. And it gives owners and trainers more incentive to keep those horses together, you know, and not try to get rid of them. Because I think that's an interesting point that Bill brought up, the selling races. Because, you know, it's just so mysterious now in these claiming races when you have these huge drop downs. Sometimes they're perfectly sound and went off for fun and the owners are just trying to get out and get the purse money for whatever reason. And then a lot of times they're trying to get rid of the horse. And I think that's what we as an industry are trying to get rid of, is horses being dumped who are unsound and being really made to run when they shouldn't be. And then, you know, that's a big problem in the claiming game. And it's a big problem for everybody. Like, you know, I don't want to keep going back to handicappers, but I've said this before that you have no idea. You're completely in the dark when you see these big drop downs in claiming races. And I don't think that's good for anybody. So, you know, it's a multi-layered problem. And I agree with Brian that we shouldn't get rid of claiming races, you know, altogether. I don't think that's good. I think there are some benefits to it, but I think most people would agree that the incentives for claiming races are kind of out of whack, you know, compared to what these horses are worth. And I think that's something that needs to be addressed. And I give a shout out to the Jockey Club for bringing that up.
Yeah, I also talked a little bit. One more thing.
Go ahead, John.
So if we, just to perpetuate the getting rid of a lot of the lower price claiming races, you know, the good side would be hopefully horses would last longer, or horses that don't deserve to run anymore would move on to you know, to other occupations or other ventures. But the other thing it would do is it would force people who want to play at that level to go to sales, which would be a positive. Because what Brian and I have talked about ad nauseum for the past couple of years is that, you know, there's such a divide at the yearling sales and the two-year-old sales that there's no buyer market for horses that are like $20,000 or under. And if you got rid of the lower claiming prices, I'm just kind of thinking this off the top of my head, but if you got rid of the lower claiming prices and then you would either, and people still wanted to get into the business, it would kind of drive them to the sales to buy younger horses at that lower price point instead of those horses going to the islands or Korea or not being sold at all. It would just give another marketplace to that lower, you know, kind of rung which is something that the breeders and sellers have been talking about for years, is that there isn't a marketplace for, you know, for that kind of a horse.
Yeah, I mean, and you never know. Like, you know, look at Swiss Skydiver, $35,000 Keeneland September purchase is now one of the top two fillies in the country. Obviously, you also have Gavin, it was $1.8 million. But there are a lot of good horses to be found. And there's also something that was touched on the roundtable. John Gosden was talking about, you know, if he had, you know, refused every incorrect horse that came to his barn, he wouldn't have won a lot of the top races that he's won. And I think that that's a good point, is that we do need more people at the lower level of the market buying these horses and keeping them in America. And you can find bargains. And some people just, you know, they don't think that way. And you know, it makes it tough for a lot of breeders and consigners and owners and everybody that's trying to sell these horses, that there just really isn't a market for it right now. If you reduce the claiming game, then maybe there would be more people trying to spend that money at the sales. I think that's an interesting point.
I think the biggest part of this that we really don't talk about, or, you know, we haven't talked about at least this time, is the expenses. And I don't know how you fix that, but that's kind of always the killer with, you know, owning horses. And it's an issue with claimers, you know, in the obviously sales horses. And I think that's part of the reason why, if you had 10 grand to spend and you could either buy a yearling or claim a horse for 10, you'd always claim the horse for 10, because you don't have to pay to have them broke and trained and everything. And it's going to take a lot more to get into the races. And I think that's a big part of why people get aggressive with claims, with horses they're dropping, because, you know, they're just trying to get out and they're just trying to not pay another $3,000 for the next X number of months, hoping the horse will turn it around. And I don't know. I mean, there's really no, I don't know if there's a way to fix that. We can maybe do a few things to bring costs down a little bit, but I mean, it's an expensive
like what? Sport.
I don't know how you fix that. I mean, I remember when we were talking about the trainer expenses, there was, you know, when Dan Ross wrote those stories, there was talk about maybe the tracks kind of being sourcing stuff like feed and maybe, you know, helping to drop prices down a little bit by buying in bulk. That's not going to move the needle that much, but I mean, maybe that's one idea. There obviously, you know, there'd be need to be a lot more changes made, but, and I don't know. I mean, I think vet work is probably a little overpriced, but I don't know how you change that market.
Well, and the problem is that we have to do so much vet work on the horses, Brian. You're exactly right.
Right.
Not even so much even that a LASIK shot is $100 and it should be $82 or you know, anything like that. Right. That you have to do so much maintenance on the horses to keep up, you know, because maybe they're not as sound, or because you're trying to keep up with the Joneses who are, you know, injecting their horses with nefarious stuff. And you need to do things still legally, but you need to do a lot more for your horses to try to get them to that higher level. And it's just a terrible cycle.
Right.
So I think you're right. That it's the medication and the vet bills more so than the other stuff. Cause they've talked about doing co-ops for feed and hay and things like that. And it would, you know, bring costs down a little bit, but it's the other stuff. It's the bigger ticket items, I think, that are really the killer.
Hey guys, this is Al Stahl. Congrats on your 50th of the show.
This week's news is sponsored by West Point Thoroughbreds. Owning multiple graded stakes winning racehorses like Hard Not to Love and Decorated Invader is attainable with a racing partnership like West Point Thoroughbreds. Partnerships enable you to spread your ownership across several horses for less than it costs to own one horse alone. This increases your racetrack action and chances for a big horse. Learn more about why West Point Thoroughbreds is the gold standard in racing partnerships at westpointtb.com. So it wasn't a huge weekend of racing. I think we've hit kind of that little dog days of summer right now. We do have the Pacific Classic coming up this weekend, which will be pretty interesting with Maximum Security. I think it's not a stellar field, but it'll be interesting to see him back at a mile and a quarter. But over the weekend, we had Swiss Skydiver, who was super dominant in the Alabama. Mentioned her before. Just a $35,000 Keeneland September buy. Real good bargain hunting there by Peter Callahan and Kenny McPeak. There was a little bit of question, I thought, about whether or not she was a mile and a quarter horse. She was passed late, and kind of Art Collector was going away from her in the mile and an eighth bluegrass. But I think that might be because he heard that I picked him in a supplemental draft and he was extra motivated. But Swiss Skydiver really, really, I thought, you know, proved herself to be, you know, just right on the level of Gamine. If maybe not quite on that level, maybe just a tick below, but she's, she's right up there with her. Obviously, Gamine has the questions about whether she's going to be as good going two turns as seven furlongs to a mile. But really dominant performance by Swiss Skydiver. Favorite of the show, Harvey's Little Goyle. I actually bet her, and I thought she made a good run on the turn, and then just kind of flattened out in the stretch. I really could have used her at least holding on for a second there. But I know Bill is obsessed with the Kentucky Oaks, I'd put it that way at this point. And I wanted to know your thoughts on that, on the Alabama and the potential matchup of her and Gamine.
Well, because I'm the TDN's intrepid Kentucky Oaks reporter with my TDN top 10, and I'm trying to come out with one now, and coming up with 10 horses is impossible. There may only be an 8 or 9 horse field in that. But the Kentucky Oaks to me is going to be what racing can be when it at its very best. I love races like this, when you have superstar horses meeting each other on the racetrack and you get a definitive, or you hope to get a definitive answer to who's better. And, you know, this is what we always wanted from Rachel Alexander and Zenyatta. I don't think these two, just because they're three-year-olds, can quite be talked about in that same perspective yet. But you have these two fabulous horses that are going to meet now in the Oaks. And they're also very different horses. Like you said, Joe, I mean, Gamine is this horse with a lot of speed. She's winning 7 furlongs in a mile. Now, Swiss Skydiver, when has this ever happened in history, is turning back in distance to run in the Kentucky Oaks from a mile and a quarter to a mile and an eighth. So, you know, I don't know who the favorite's going to be. I don't know who's going to win. I have no idea. But I do know that, you know, I can't wait for this race. And, you know, the Kentucky Derby is a Kentucky Derby. Nothing's going to steal its spotlight. This is a lot better race than the Kentucky Derby, if you ask me.
Yeah, I mean, you got, don't forget Speech as well. So you got a couple of real top-class three-year-olds that I think could arguably compete in the Derby. Especially Gamine, you know, she's so fast, and, you know, maybe she would get burned up in a hot pace in the Derby, but I think she would be one of the top three choices in the Derby for sure. And Swiss Skydiver, I think, wouldn't be worse than, like, you know, fourth or fifth choice maybe in the Derby. She did go favored in the Bluegrass over our Collector slightly, fractionally, as I like to say. But I agree. I mean, it's a little bit overlooked in normal years, the Oaks compared to the Derby, but the Derby, I don't think is super, super interesting this year. You know, I tis the law makes it interesting because of the connections and the New York bred thing, and just such a cool horse that's run, you know, is trying to go for that quadruple crown. And Art Collector, I think, has a big shot. But after that, like, it's tough to get super excited about anybody in the Derby, at least from my vantage point. But any other thoughts on the Alabama from either of you guys?
Well, not even so much the Alabama as the upcoming Oaks. I mean, you're talking about a David versus Goliath, a Seabiscuit versus War Admiral, and now you have, you know, Swiss Skydiver and Gamine. Just as far as purchase price alone, you know, one was, like you said, a bargain basement kind of horse that was overlooked, and then you have the horse that sold for you know, well into seven figures in Gamine. They have two different run, you know, types of running style, and like Bill said, it's unusual to see a filly at this stage of her career turning back in distance to go shorter in the Oaks. I don't agree with you, Joe, about, you know, that the Derby isn't going to be an exciting race. I think that it is, and I think that we're probably going to have a podcast to talk about that, about just how exciting of a race it is. So
I've been talking about it for 9 months, so I'm just,
I know, over. This has been the longest preview of the Kentucky Derby history, and hopefully it'll always be the longest one, you know, before the next. But before we know it, we're going to be talking about, you know, May of 2022, you know, and or 2021, I guess, comes after 2020, right? You can tell how well I did in math. Anyway. But yeah, I really think that having these two fillies peak at this time, or even three fillies if you want to include the other one, peaking at this time. And you know, Bill, I know you're lamenting the fact that there's only going to be 8 or 9 horses in there, but I think you're right. There's going to be a lot of good racing, you know, in those 2 minutes when they go around the oval at Churchill. It's going to be the Oaks is going to be really exciting, and I think it is going to steal a lot of the spotlight away from Tis the Law and the rest of the group that's running the Derby.
Yeah, I mean, I'm with you guys. I'm certainly excited for the race. I already know what's going to happen. I'm going to bet Swiss Skydiver and Gamine's going to win by 10. But I think I do agree with kind of the questions about Gamine at a mile and an eighth. But I mean, she's obviously just a little monster. It wouldn't shock me at all if she could see out the distance.
What do we think their prices are going to be? I feel like Gamine will be 4 to 5 or so. Swiss Skydiver will be like 5 to 2.
Oh, I think it'll be closer than that, Joe. I really do.
I think people are like those big figures for Gamine, I think people are going to get, you know, entranced by that.
But I mean, that's the problem. There's so much to like about each horse, you know, and, you know, they're both going to have their fans. I do think that, you know, people are going to look at the fact that Gamine is unproven at the mile and eighth is going to be a factor, but I could be totally wrong about this. That's one thing that's interesting to me. I don't think anybody knows, and I'd like to hear from both John and Brian about this as well. First of all, who do you pick if it's going to be one of the two, and what are the prices going to be? I think it'd be more about the 6-5, 9-5 neighborhood, something like that.
I mean, the exacto will be like $7 once this guy runs second to Gamine.
Yeah, exactly. I think if it was a match race, I always try to take the front runner because I think that they can control the race, they can control the speed, and they can control the tempo. Obviously, it's not a match race. There will be something else in there. But I think Gamine is just so fast that she can run horses off their feet. And then it becomes a matter of, you know, just how patient is Swiss Skydiver in being able to try to run her down. And there's going to be other factors. There's going to be 6 or 7 other horses in the race that are going to get in people's way or going to break funny. And that's why you can't, you know, you can't pick races just on paper because you need a little bit of racing luck to develop in order to get, you know, your horse across the wire the first time. But I'm always partial to horses that can run from the front end because they can dictate the race as opposed to horses that have to sit off it and hope for an opening or hope that they have, that they, you know, will be able to come around the top of the stretch and pass everyone else.
I guess I kind of agree with Joe on price, you know, price expectations. People just go so nuts for Baffert. I mean, and with those figures, I think she's still going to be a pretty heavy favorite. I mean, she has a huge figure edge on Swiss Skydiver. You know, obviously, we have reasons to believe that their figures might come together a bit, but, you know, she's what, like 15 points faster on buyers? Or what was her really big number?
It's
She got a 110 in the Acorn, then a 108 in the test.
And okay, Swiss Skydiver,
not quite that much.
102 but top in the
102, so a little less than that. But still, I mean, I think people see Baffert and they see a 110 buyer and, you know, a lot of people are just going to send it in. So I think, you know, Swiss Skydiver might offer value at like a 2-1 if she gets to that price.
So there was some news this week about Monmouth Park not paying out purses since like very early in the meet, supposedly because of testing issues, which is kind of funny to me that they had Service and Navarro dominating the standings for so long and, you know, didn't seem to have any testing issues then, but now it seems like there's a big backlog. But John knows more about this, and specifically because he hasn't gotten paid, and we all know how desperate he is for funds these days.
It's still money is still money, my friend. It's still part of it. But yeah, it's been a disappointment because Monmouth is our home track, and there were some articles that came out over the weekend about how the trainers and owners who have earned purse monies haven't been paid since opening weekend. So now it's 6-7 weeks in duration, in delay, since people have gotten paid. And normally you would say, oh, boo-hoo, you know, you can wait 6 weeks, 7 weeks, and it's not going to break you. But you have to remember that a lot of these trainers just got through the pandemic issue and haven't been racing on a consistent basis since March. So now it's not a matter of 6 or 7 weeks from the time they're getting paid. Now it's really going into months and months since they haven't been paid. And there are people that rely on them. There's their help, you know, their grooms, their hot walkers, their assistant trainers. And, you know, it's also other parts of the industry. It's the feed company. It's the, you know, the vets and all the other people who service the horses that now are not getting paid for months and months and months. And there definitely is a trickle down, situation. Where if the money's not flowing through to the trainers and the owners, then it's definitely not flowing through to these vendors. So I'm not campaigning about this or talking about this because I'm worried about, you know, some of the owners at Monmouth Park. It's really for all the little guys and people that, you know, service the industry and get the horses to where they are in racing condition, putting the horses in the races, getting them to run to their best of their abilities safely, and then not getting compensated for it. And I know it's not all Monmouth's fault. It really has to do with the fact that there's long delays in the post-race drug testing from the testing centers. But Monmouth Park is being run by one of the top attorneys in the country, in Dennis Drazen, and you would think that they would have either an alternative, a plan B for a secondary testing site, or there would be some kind of action on their part from a legal standpoint to follow through to get these people paid. Because again, it's not just the Baffert's of the world that won the Haskell and you're worried about him getting his percentage. It's for all the people that are running their horses and the $10,000 claimers and making the races go. So there is a betting product and not getting paid for it.
Yeah, it's like is there any word about, when this is going to get sorted out? Is there any kind of, indication of when people are going to start getting paid?
I wish there was, Joe. It's a great question. As of now, there's not. There's nothing. It's I wouldn't say it's radio silence because they did put out some articles about this, and Dennis Drazen was quoted saying that the horsemen are struggling. People can't pay their bills and it's a trickle down effect. And he's gotten complaints from other vendors because the horsemen can't pay. So I think that there is going to be some kind of a rallying cry and something to be done. But when you're talking about 6 or 7 weeks, it's not like last week we were talking about Saudi Arabia and how ridiculous it was that they weren't paying, the winners or anybody for that matter, any of the purse money that they had earned, from February. And we said, oh, it's because they play by their own rules. Well, here we are. It's a Class A track in Monmouth Park. And yet basically, the same end result is happening. It's not the reason why it's happening, but it's the same end result. People aren't getting paid.
And again, like super ironic considering the two guys who dominated the standings there for so long and didn't seem to be big concerned about testing then. But, we hope that gets settled and people start getting paid. Because it's a good point that John brings up that it's not just the time since the beginning of the meet. It's also a lot of people that have not been able to race regularly since, February or March or even before that. So it's not a good situation. And I don't know, got to get it together. Like you said, it's not all mama's fault, but to have no light at the end of the tunnel there, it's a bad situation. Joining a West Point Thoroughbreds partnership can vault you into the world of instant camaraderie among people surrounding high-class horses and stakes action for a fraction of the cost of trying to do it on your own. Learn more at westpointtb.com.
Congratulations on the 50th edition of the TDN Writers Podcast. I find it really beneficial for me each week to hit the pause button and I listen to the podcast. I find myself entertained and informed, educated, but I think most importantly, inspired to be a better member of the Thoroughbred community. So keep up the great work you're doing week in and week out. And I'd say just continue to address the very difficult issues that we're facing as an industry in the headfirst manner that you've done for the last 50 episodes. And if you do that, and we continue to talk about things and we take action as a result of that dialogue, the industry has no choice but to get better. And for that, I say thank you to the TDN team and the people who participate in the Writers Podcast.
So Bill had a really interesting story in today's TDN about the new timing system that has been instituted at a lot of tracks across the country. I believe 11 tracks is the number, and it's owned by Equibase. It's called GMAX, and it relies on GPS to time horses, not just at the front of the pack, but horses, further back in the field at different times, different fractional times, and it's creating some problems. And I think there are some people, especially figure makers, who are kind of protesting here and saying that Equibase needs to get it together. Bill, what were your impressions about whether or not this is going to be remedied, whether or not this thing's going to stick around? What were your thoughts on the reactions you got?
Well, is it going to stick around? Yes. After I started reporting on this story and a lot of people are talking about it now. I had wondered if the Jockey Club at some point would say, hey, we agree this thing has problems, some bugs in it. Let's just put it back on the back burner and not unveil it or not use it at racetracks until we get all the bugs fixed. And that has not been their opinion. I mean, they sort of dug their heels in a little bit, saying a couple things, some of which are rather controversial. First of all, they say it's really not that bad at all. They've also made the point that, hey, if we're off by 2/5 of a second here, 1/5 of a second there, is that really such a big deal? Well, I think most people would say, yes, it is. And, also there are examples where they're off by a second, sixth-fifths, seventh-fifths, et cetera. So they seem to be digging their heels in. And, you know, I don't know what this is eventually is going to lead, but they're also aggressively selling this. And, you know, we have 11 tracks today. In 2021, a year from now, we might have 19, 20, 21 tracks. And, you know, this is kind of a mess. I don't want to inject too much of an opinion into it because, you know, I was a news reporter writing the story. So, you know, I'm going to let other people either rail against this if you guys want to do that. But, you know, it's a serious problem. And, you know, one thing that is certain, though, that to say that people, if the jockey club is saying, well, you know, accuracy, and maybe I'm being a little bit unfair or putting words in their mouth, but I'm not sure that I am. They're saying, well, 100% accuracy just isn't that important. No, it is.
Yeah, no, that was the quote that really stood out to me where I forget who it was, but someone from the jockey club said that, well, we're getting 95% of races right to within 2/5 of a second. It's like, that's not good enough, you know, in a sport, in a game where time is super important and, you know, tens of millions of dollars of betting dollars are reliant on accurate times. Like, I don't think that you should be patting yourselves on the back for getting it right, getting it sort of right 95% of the time. I should say that the way races were traditionally timed was the teletimer, which has an invisible beam that's tripped when a horse crosses it. Didn't seem to have that many problems over time. I guess, you know, that isn't 100% accurate either. But this is supposed to be an improvement. You know, this is not supposed to be just, you know, a different version of the status quo. And I think, you know, Trackus has kind of pushed the industry in this direction of trying to involve more technology in the timing of races. And it's just there's really no excuse for not having, you know, accurate times, if not 100% of the time, then 99% of the time, to have figure makers have to go back and hand time races. I think the other factor about this that, you know, some people don't talk about is the vagaries of how races are timed in terms of run-ups, in terms of different distances. I think that's a big issue as well. Like, you know, the run-up distances vary so much from track to track, and even within the same track from distance to distance. And that seems like an antiquated thing to me. I think that the race should just start at the, and it's not 100%, you know, feasible all the time because of the way the tracks are configured, but just start the race, start the clock. I never really got why we need these long run-ups to start the time for these races. It just, I don't know. It makes no sense to me. And I think that's a big problem with it. And that's why people can't really do accurate timing, especially in hand timing, because you don't know exactly, you know, how long the run-up is. You know, it's a mess. And it's not something that I think should be this complicated to time races accurately in a sport where speed figures have become so integral to handicapping, as well as for owners to figure out where to place their horses. I know a lot of owners rely on buyer figures and Ragusan sheets and Thoragraph numbers to, you know, spot their horses, and trainers do as well. It's just, to me, it's unacceptable for a sport that's so reliant on time and figures to still be screwing this up, especially after instating a new system. Like, that's supposed to be an improvement, and to have the answer that, oh, well, we get it mostly right most of the time. Like, I don't think that's remotely good enough. And it's frankly kind of embarrassing, I think, for racing to still be dealing with these timing issues. I don't know that any other sport would put up with this. I wonder if John or Brian have any thoughts on this.
Yeah, Joe, you stole my thunder, basically, because it's one thing when you talk about accuracy and the timing, that's important, because every, you know, the reason why we're even still at fifths of a second is because a fifth basically represents one length of distance, you know, in a race. But almost more importantly, the times are the bedrock for a lot of the other metrics that are involved in racing, and a lot of the other metrics that are involved and publicized and sought after by owners and trainers and breeders, like you mentioned. You know, you have buyer numbers, which are front and center, you know, on every single race. And that is one of the most important figures. Some argue that was the most important figures on a racing form. And then you have Thoromanager, Thoragraph, the Ragusan sheets and the likes. But they have taken on a life, all these metrics have taken on such a life of their own that they are actually included now when you log into the sale sites to see what horses have done throughout certain family lines. So it's not just a matter of, well, it's a one-off. If you're not betting on the races, then you shouldn't really care about these things. People are basing purchases of unproven horses in pedigrees based on what the second dam, you know, equibase number was. Well, if that's an erroneous number because it's based on a faulty time, then yeah, 95% is not a passing grade in this case. And again, it's not life and death, but it is literally tens of millions of dollars that shift from one position to the other based on, you know, some of these figures. And Brian, you talked last week about, you know, a horse that was running at Ellis Park that broke its maiden first time out, and whether or not it was going to be, you know, resold for $400, $500, $600 or $1 million. And the big linchpin in all of it was really what the buyer number was going to be. Well, if that race was 2/5 of a second off, then the buyer number would shift. And that's hundreds of thousands of dollars of difference just on that one horse.
Right. And I mean, a lot of stallions are advertised based on their speed figures. Joe kind of touched on this. It just makes racing look like such a Mickey Mouse sport again. I mean, could you imagine if, you know, there were Olympic trials and they're like, oh, oops, we're off by a second. It's ridiculous. There's no excuse for it. I had written a couple stories a while back about workout inaccuracies, and I'd kind of propose this system because eventually they're going to use this for workouts too. And I'd propose this as maybe something that would help improve workout time accuracies, which are far less important than racing times. And a couple of people had said to me, you know, good luck. It's not going to be that effective. So I guess those people were right. Hopefully they can remedy it. I agree. The flippant response is kind of just shocking. You know, I'd hate to be a figure maker and have to hand time all these races, and just, it's got to make their jobs a lot tougher. I mean, racing needs to fix a lot of things. This is probably not on the top of the list, but it seems like it should be a very easy, obvious thing in 2020 when, you know, technology can do it.
I'm just curious for Bill, how did you get tipped off to this? Were there like figure makers that reached out to you? Like what was the impetus for this story?
We were tipped off to this, that there was some problems here. And then, you know, people were starting to funnel me information. And I even got like, you know, anonymous stuff that I'm not going to use in a story from I'm the track man at so-and-so track. And, you know, there's been 500 wrong times and everything like that. But you can't use that. But, you know, and I think people who came forward, and especially, you know, Andy Byer and Randy Moss were two of the main voices in my story. Randy Moss, of course, produces the Byer figures as one of the team members of the team that produces them. And they generally did it out of concern that, you know, this is not okay that, you know, racing to have these inaccurate times for all the reasons that, you know, you guys have spoken about that, and it needs to be fixed. And one of the things that I didn't get this in the store, but there is kind of an easy fix to this. So one thing we haven't talked about is Equibase said that this thing is fantastic because it has all these bells and whistles. We can do this and we can do that. We can eventually time workouts and we can give you, you know, the times on every single horse at any point in the race. And we can do all these neat graphics and everything that are going to be something that's going to appeal to people. Well, then that's fine. I think then use that for everything but timing. If in fact this thing turns out to be not that good at timing, just stick to the teletimer system. You know, that's one thing that's interesting. You know, the teletimer's been around since 1938. And, you know, every once in a while, there's a problem with it. But if any of us ever been railing about, oh, the timing of races is so bad in the sport, these teletimers have to go. No, by and large, it works. So, you know, why get rid of something that works and replace it with something that it looks like doesn't work nearly as well? You know, it's 2020. Why should we be taking a step backwards rather than a step forwards? And by all indications, this thing is a step backwards.
Yeah, I mean, increasing technology and getting worse results is obviously not the way to go. And this is, I don't know, we should have like a weekly segment where it's like the weekly facepalm moment of racing. And it's just, this should be that one this week.
That's the emoji we're going to use.
So this is a big week for us, and it's stunning to me that we've hit this mark already. But this week is our 50th episode. We've been doing this a little bit under a year. We started late August last year at the TDN Writers Room, and I think we've grown a lot. We're still as immature as ever, but I think in terms of our discussions, I think we've grown a lot, and I think you know, we've made at least a little bit of an impact. I know a lot of people are talking about us as that goddamn podcast. So we'll take that. That'll be our alternate name for the writer's room. But I wanted to shout out everybody that's been a part of this from the jump. And we're going to have a very special guest in a little bit to talk about it. But, you know, Sue Finley has obviously given us the green light, and our producer Patty Wolf and everybody at the Patty Wolf Media Group has done a great job with the editing and all of that. And Bill Finley has been great from day one. John Green. I went back and I was looking at some of the notes from one of the early episodes. We interviewed you before you became on the show. I felt like you were the guest, and then we had you on after that as a regular contributor. Is that true?
You've never gotten rid of me.
I can't even remember what I would want to ask you, like, because you're so uninteresting that I'm not, I don't know.
Yeah. And then I just never left. I never left the studio, and you guys couldn't get rid of me. It's true.
But no, I mean, this is a big thing for us. And, you know, we've picked up sponsors. We've grown our listenership and our viewership. We've adapted throughout the pandemic to have our presence on Vimeo and YouTube now, where you can see all of our beautiful mugs every week. And I think, you know, if anything, it's only made the show better. But just one thing I wanted to you know, I don't want to pat ourselves on the back too much, but I think one of the things we do really well here is that we talk about structural industry issues and whether or not those issues are fixed or whether or not we have any impact with our discussions. I think it's good to get these kind of things out into the air, you know, every single week and you know, air the dirty laundry sometimes of this sport, because I think, you know, not to name any names, but I think there's a lot of people in racing media who are just, they're just cheerleaders and just want to only focus on the positive things. And, you know, listen, we love racing. We like to talk about big races and exciting horses and all the positive stuff as well. But I think it's also important for people that do have a voice and do have a face in racing to talk about these, you know, real deep-seated issues that racing has. And I think we're going to continue to do that. We've had a lot of great guests. I think our guests have grown in quality over the time. We had Bob Baffert, Chad Brown. I think Chad Brown was definitely one of our best guests. And, you know, I want to thank everybody who has come on, because, you know, they don't have to do that as enticing as the free 1 hour tax consultation is. I think they're mostly doing it because they like our work. They like the TDN, and, you know, they do want to have these discussions. But I guess I'll just open it up to the floor real quick. And like I said, we don't want to, you don't want to pat ourselves on the back too much, but just some of the things that you guys have really remembered and really, you know, valued from these first 50 weeks.
Well, Joe, I totally agree with you. I mean, I value and really like the banter and the discussion and the deep dive into the issues. And, you know, again, we have to be careful here, because this isn't all about us patting ourselves on the back and being self-congratulatory. But I think that's why people have gravitated towards this and do appreciate this, that, you know, this is a very good forum for talking about not just the, you know, who sold for what at the sales and who won this grade one race last week and who's going to run in this grade one race this week. And boy, isn't it interesting that Chad Brown won another 15 graded stakes races with fillies and mares on the turf. You know, it's more getting into the kind of issues. And, you know, I won't speak about myself. I want to congratulate you for how well you do hosting the show. And I want to congratulate all the people that are part of it, you know, Brian Jonas and Alan Carrasa, who took the week off. And you know, how do I say this without being sort of arrogant? But, you know, I think we are intelligent voices. And I think that people really appreciate that. And I look forward to 500 more weeks.
500 weeks. Wow. That's amazing. That would be an incredible thing. 10 years?
Fuck. Why not?
Yeah. Something to shoot for. Absolutely. I can tell you.
Maybe John can grow a beard by then.
Tony, give me a week, dude. Give me a week. I can remember walking into the studio for the very first time. I think you guys were on show like 5 or 6, and just being like super nervous. And it wasn't because I didn't think that we could, you know, all keep up with each other as far as talking about things, but it was that you guys have worked together and worked so well, and all of your articles and reporting in the TDN was always something that was a first read for me as an owner and breeder in the industry. And so I remember walking into the studio and sitting down and trying to get myself together. And I don't remember which one of you looked over, but basically you were like, you kind of gave me a head nod. And at the time I was like, oh, that's cool. Okay. I'm part of the group. And in reality it was, put your headphones on, you idiot. Otherwise you won't be able to. And that was like my seminal moment of like coming in, coming into the group. So I was like the new kid that came in to the school like mid semester and was a little intimidated. Because again, my background is in journalism and I was a communications major in college. So I always enjoyed reading and listening to the things that you guys put out there for the TDN. So it's been a really great learning curve for me as far as, doing it in this forum. And I agree with Bill in the sense that, we've all added very intelligent, thought-provoking comments on a variety of different topics. And we all have different angles and different thoughts, and interests in this business. So it's not always whoever speaks the loudest or the longest is going to be, the winner of it. There's been a lot of really cutting remarks that that made me rethink and kind of reconfigure my thought process on topics that I look at from an owner's standpoint, but you guys are looking at it from a handicapping standpoint and from a reporter's standpoint. So it's really brought me into, thinking about the industry as a whole and trying to make it better, for everyone involved and not just, the people who are running in graded stake races, but the breeders, the owners, the trainers and everyone who makes a living at this, that needs this industry to be perpetuated and be better, over time. And I hope that's what, that's what my focal point has been, is trying to make the industry better, for future generations.
Yeah, I've really enjoyed it. I think we have a good back and forth and all that. I think we probably came about at a good time with, obviously the last 6 months or whatever it's been has been a particularly strange time in the world and a particularly strange time in racing. And I think back to that episode we had when the indictments broke, I think that was still probably maybe our best episode and just sort of our most relevant. And that was kind of right when the pandemic was starting. So I think it's kind of been nice to have been able to have a face to face with some you guys and talk racing, and it's kind of I hope my family's not watching. It's a little better than the Zooms we have as a family every once in a while, a little more interesting. I've enjoyed it, and I think we've definitely added a lot to the the racing media landscape.
I totally agree about the episode after the indictments hit. I believe it was like March 8th or so, somewhere around there. If you haven't listened to it, go back and listen to it. I think that was definitely our best episode.
I honestly was surprised at my own reaction on Monday, that I was giddy. I felt like I was on a natural high all day when I got this news, because you just become so resigned to the idea that there are people that are cheating and drugging horses and killing horses in racing, and no consequences are ever going to come from it. That's a part of you that is, I guess I didn't realize, is so ingrained, such a depressing thing that's so ingrained in me as a racing fan, that I couldn't believe how happy I was when I heard this news. And it's like, it says a lot about the like inert fog that racing has been in when it comes to this issue, that I was so giddy. And I'm not the only one. I think most people were happy about it. I mean, usually in a sport, if the FBI comes in and busts 27 people in your sport, including some of the biggest names in the game, that's bad news. Yep. But in this case, the fact that there were finally some consequences for this behavior felt like a gift from above. And so I guess that's not good, but it is good if indeed this is the turning point. It has the potential to be, whatever it takes to clean up this sport, whether it's law enforcement, should be seen as tremendous progress. And I think you guys are 100% right that this is a crossroads. This is a chance for racing to finally admit to itself how much dirty crap it has allowed to fester in this game for so long, or it can just brush it under the rug and go on as business as usual. So I hope for the best, but I'm going to have to see it first.
It was so cathartic to be able to talk about all these things that a lot of people really didn't want to talk about for a long time. And not to digress, but at the Jockey Club roundtable, Stuart Janney said that there might be more indictments, or there should be more indictments coming. So hopefully we can have like a part two of that, where we can air our grievances. Just to add on to what you guys said, I think Bill does a great job and has a really good perspective as an intrepid reporter at the TDN. He says a lot of smart stuff. I when I go back and watch the episode again, I think I notice more and more smart things that Bill says, that kind of make me think a little bit more about what I say. And John, you know, I love to rip John. It's just, it's a lot of fun, but he really has kind of come in and seamlessly been part of the team here. And I think, you know, he's obviously a really smart guy. He's got a journalism background, and it didn't, you know, we didn't know like what it was going to be like when we brought him in. I didn't know John from Adam when we first brought him in, but he really has been, you know, has just, like I said, seamlessly joined the crew and does a great job every week. And Brian is a really good voice to have because he's a young guy. He's an owner. He's a thoughtful guy. So we appreciate having him on every week. And Al, I think, does a great job as well. He has a really well-rounded view of racing. So I just wanted to tip my hat to all you guys for doing this every week, because it's been great for me too. I think I've really grown as like an analyst and a, you know, on camera personality now, to talk to you guys every week and you know, bandy these issues about. And it only gets better. I think it only gets better every single week. And so with that, we want to welcome our Green Group Guest of the Week. The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. With over 500 clients in the horse business, they have proven strategies to save you taxes. Learn more about how they can help you at greenco.com. So this week's Green Group Guest of the Week, we're gonna throw it in a little bit different direction, but probably the most important Green Group Guest of the Week we've had so far on this show through 50 episodes. And it is our incredible producer, Patty Wolf. And she's a legend. She is a legend in the media game. But most importantly, she had the idea for the TDN Writers Room from the jump. This was her brainchild. And Patty, welcome to your first on-camera appearance on the show.
Well, now everyone will know why I am behind the camera all the time. Okay. And where I'm more comfortable. But thank you. Thanks. Yeah, I'm here with you every week anyway, but this is the first time you're seeing.
So it's great to have you. Like I said, this was your baby. This was your idea from the jump. And you've really been kind of our number one fan from the jump. And you know, we really appreciate like everything you do, not even just behind the scenes, because you and your team do an incredible job producing the show every single week and editing the show, really turning it around quickly. And, you know, I think it's only gotten better and better as we've gone on, but really just in terms of support, in terms of, you know, being involved, like you're definitely super integral to every single week and the process that we have. So want to thank you for all that, but I also want to ask, you know, what your original idea was for the show, to just tell our audience, and then kind of how you've seen it grow and evolve over time.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. So I started bugging Sue about this a while ago. It was long before we actually started. And I think our first show was August 28th of last year. But I had been in her ear because I'm a big podcast person, Audible books, whatever. I've always got the headphones in or in the car. And there's one podcast that I loved, and it was the NPR Politics Weekly Roundup. And the reason I loved it was because it was reporters, people that are used to just reporting the stories at NPR, never being celebrities themselves, never having their own voices or opinions, just really good reporters. And they would sit around once a week, or if they still do, I still listen. And it was so fascinating to get people who really, you know, knew their stuff, as opposed to people who just are slick on camera. So I said to Sue, you've got such a smart staff. I mean, the TDN reporting is just above all else. I love it. I've been a TDN fan since the beginning. So I said to her, can we get some of the writers to sit around and, you know, do this? And for a while it was, you know, just put on the shelf as an idea we talked about. And then I can't remember what happened, whether it was talking to you, Joe, that might've been it, when Sue said, hey, you know, we've got buy-in here. We'll do it. We'll give it a try. So we set up the conference room at the TDN with four mics and a board, which Joe learned to work the board right away. But I really thought that the show was going to be, let's wrap up what happened last weekend in racing or sales or, you know, whatever news there was in the sport. And by the way, the second half, let's preview what's coming up. I didn't think it was going to be boring. Of course, we all want that information. But from the first minute, I wasn't in the room for the first few because I didn't want to make you guys uncomfortable. I was right outside the glass, but I couldn't hear. So I had to hear off of the card, the memory card, when it was over. And from show one, I said, oh, this thing's got a life of its own. And you guys just took it. So yeah, it changed a lot from the initial thought for the better. Who knew the kinds of stories that were going to come your way? This crazy year that has been in the sport, outside the sport, but there was no topic you guys weren't willing to tackle. I was your number one fan. I continue to be the number one fan, and I listen to the show more times than anybody else as well. Or maybe Anthony matches me, our editor. But and I listen after it goes out on the TDN blast. I listen again, partially out of paranoia that we missed an edit or something. But mainly, I really enjoy it. Like Bill, one of the things I enjoy the most is how honest you guys are with your banter. And if you're upset with what somebody said, you don't hold back and you let them know. There's no feeling of, hey, let's take this polite and let's, you know, let's be deferential. No, you let it out. And that's just been the biggest surprise and treat for me. But the show had legs. Your personality had legs. It just went in its own way. And now all I had to do was, you know, stand there and catch it all and put it out. So beyond my expectations.
So Patty, I actually have two questions for you. One is, you know, what was your favorite moment in one of the show, you know, the past 50 shows? Okay. And the other one is who has to be edited the most out of the five of us? Who basically screws up the most, so the people, you know, who are listening know exactly, you know, what's going on?
There's a reason that John asked that question. It's because it's him. And Sue, who tries to be on, as busy as she is publishing everything at the TDN and overseeing everything, she tries to be on for one reason only, and that is John Green, who we love him. We love that, you know, you can unleash him, but sometimes he says things that we don't want to step on those toes.
We're reeling back in.
Yeah. So he knew the answer to that. The indictment show was so moving. If you had to ask me my favorite episode, that one was really, really moving. Favorite moment, and I wasn't even sure it was going to stay in the show, and it did, was your reacting to the Monomoy Girl ad, which was so funny. It was just funny to see your reaction to it and how you took that seriously. But again, that's what I like about the show, is that nobody holds back their feelings.
Yeah, it's kind of therapeutic for me also, because you can like get a lot off your chest, and people aren't necessarily kind towards it. You know, you can say what you want. Joe's gone on a couple of famous rants that actually, you know, made me chuckle a couple of times, only because I couldn't wait for him to be done to be able to like zing him with something, you know, like what? But that's this group, you know, we've kind of grown up together as you know, podcasters, and we all know we have thick enough skin where we don't take things too seriously when we pick on each other. But one of the things that I thought was my favorite moment of all the shows, and it did occur on that very, you know, open and heart-wrenching indictment show, was we were so serious about everything that was going on and how this was going to help the industry and what we needed to do to promote the industry and all those things. And Brian had one classic line in there.
But apparently none of them had ever watched a mafia movie or The Wire or anything. And they're texting each other, I need more drugs.
I think they just couldn't help themselves.
I love when they're talking for several minutes and then Navarro's like, we shouldn't talk about this on the phone. You were already talking about it on the phone.
I almost peed myself. It was so needed. It was so,
so funny because they were sending text messages and it was all so easy to document. And Brian said that.
It was just hysterical. It was so needed. I mean, it was so greatly timed because we were all so intense about it for a lot of reasons and the correct reasons. And then he was just so subtle with the line. It was, you know, it wasn't like a rim shot. That was genuinely hysterical.
Hilarious. It was hilarious.
Brian, go ahead. Let's hear another one.
I can't do it. It's got to happen naturally. Patty, I was just curious, do you have any kind of ideas, not to put you on the spot, do you have any kind of visions for the future or anything you're thinking, new segments, new anything?
Yeah, so I'm constantly, Sue and I have been friends for closer to 40 years than 30 years, somewhere in there. And constantly bombarding her with new ideas for you guys and for TDN Media build out. I think I am sometimes overwhelming. But yeah, definitely, Brian. And I would love to see you guys jump in behind the mics when we get back, when news breaks. And not to totally rip off NPR politics again, but the show is the weekly roundup, but they will jump in when important things break. So that's one thing specifically for this show. And I would love to see a little more of you guys during the week, picking up the phone, Bill, Joe, you guys in particular, I'm looking at to talk to people and record it and add that to the podcast assets and library. So,
yeah, I think that was like Patty's original idea, was to have a kind of be a reaction to breaking news, and it became more of like a long form discussion show. But I think that's definitely an idea that we can incorporate more kind of a quick reactive podcast. And it would be easier when we do get back in the studio, just to jump in there every now and then, every time some big story breaks. But Bill, I was wondering if you had any questions for our lovely producer.
Oh, Patty, it's interesting because, you know, not only are you the producer, but you're our number one fan. And, you know, what we've heard from us, why, you know, we've all been busy patting ourselves on the back, you know, why this show works. But from a fan standpoint, you know, why do you think this thing clicks?
Well, I think I can speak for myself as a fan, and I don't know if I think the way other people think, but I think I do, in that we want realness. You know, we're tired of being sold, you know, snake oil, and we're tired of things being always so slick. And I think that one of the reasons why podcasts are taking over radio, it's not just because you can listen when you can, but because there's real raw voices rising up and uniqueness. Back when media was, you know, three channels, that's it. There wasn't a lot of uniqueness. There wasn't, nobody wanted to take that chance. You know, you're competing for a share of the available audience, and you didn't want to try new things. And podcasts get us away from that. And why I love this show in particular is that rawness and that realness. And I would never want to see that change. And I try, probably don't do a great job, but I try not to overproduce you. I try to just let you go because I'm always more pleased that way. And then I have to bug you with a few, okay, we need these leads, or okay, we need this for this segment. But I try to just leave it at that, because what you come back with is so much better than anything I can feed you. And I think that the audience would respond to that. I think most people would respond to that because there's an honesty and you can trust it. So.
Patty, how did you find professionally your transition from music video star to producer of podcasts?
Oh my God. Why did I not see this one coming? There's a chip in my brain. So there was a music video back in 1982. And I went on for 30 years and never told a living soul that I did it, other than the few immediate family members that knew. And it's only because of YouTube and all of this crazy Googling people are doing that I got outed. So how did I make that transition? So much happened between that video and my life today, where it wasn't even a factor. And now it's like looking at another person who I hardly remember or know. So.
Patty, you're going to have to edit that video into the podcast. So
it's already done, Bill. Bill, it's already done.
Hundreds of thousands of listeners will be able to see.
It's already taken care of.
Because I love you, Steve. Maybe this can be the end. We had it all. Just like
our viewers need to see the most disinterested romantic interest in music video history.
I'm sorry, Joe. That's called acting, because I was directed that I was mad at him. And then he said, we're going to reflect on to happier times, right? The song is he's trying to win me back. So he said, you're mad at him. Anyway, we ran out of the budget to shoot, and we never really shot the reflecting on happier times. So I really look like
that is life in a nutshell.
Exactly.
Especially in Corona.
Especially in time of Corona, right? Well, I again would like to really thank you, Patty, because you know you're a driving force behind all of this, and we all really appreciate it. And as much as we like to prop ourselves up as being, you know, phenomenally talented and intelligent, you make us look that way. And you and your team, based on the way that you edit us and make us look smarter than we are and funnier than we are and even better looking than we are. So we can't thank you enough for all of that.
Oh, gosh. No, listen, my pleasure, my honor. Don't even.
Absolutely. I was about to do the same kind of sign off only because the lighting in my apartment is changing and Patty's going to yell at me soon if I don't correct it. But no, we love you. We appreciate you. The show wouldn't exist if it weren't for you, and it wouldn't be as good as it is today if it weren't for you and your team. I want to give a shout out to everybody in the Patty Wolf Media Group too. You guys do a great job and we appreciate it. Here's to 50 more episodes at least.
You're here. Thank you.
Thanks, Patty. The Green Group guest of the week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. As this week's Green Group guest of the week, Patty Wolf will receive a free one-hour tax consultation. Learn more about how they can help you at www.greenco.com.
Sailing away to Key Largo. Here's looking at you, Key. Missing all the things we did.
We'll be right back after this message from The Green Group.
The Green Group is widely recognized as the top-rated tax and accounting firm specializing in the horse business. Why do the top owners, breeders, pinhookers, and trainers trust The Green Group as their tax advisors? The difference is experience. Firm founder Len Green has over four decades of experience owning, breeding, and racing horses. First-hand knowledge gives Green Group clients proven tax and money-saving strategies. Visit The Green Group at www.greenco.com. The Green Group, proven strategies to save you taxes.
Hey, TDN Writers Room podcast team, on behalf of Woodbine Entertainment and Racing Across Canada, congratulations on your 50th show. Keep it up. We love what you are doing. Hashtag Bravo.
So that's going to put a bow on the 50th episode of the TDN Writers Room presented by Keeneland. Remember to check out the Keeneland September catalog online now at september.keeneland.com. I want to thank Bill Finley, John Green, Brian DiDonato, our Green Group guest of the week, and our producer, Patty Wolf, Anthony LaRocca, and Danny Siper, our editors, and our production coordinator, Michelle Sabrino. Thank you so much for watching. Here's to at least 50 more episodes. Still wear a mask. We'll see you next week.